It's with a great deal of delight that I have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. William Willimon to our wintry wonderland to present the Winchell Lecture for 1987. I could squeeze a couple more W's in. Dr. Willimon, as you probably have already read in the brochure and so forth, is minister to the university and professor of the practice of Christian ministry at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Although I never had the pleasure until yesterday evening to meet him personally, like many of you, my acquaintance too goes back some years, particularly through the pages of Christian Century, who engages him as an editor-at-large, and for whom he has written for some years some very fine meditations, which we sell in our bookstore under the title On a Wild and Windy Mountain, or at least a number of the meditations in there I have seen on the pages of the Christian Century, and certainly through the chapters of some nearly 30 books that he has authored. By the way, in case Abington should fail to inform you, I happen to know that in the last few weeks our bookstore has sold at least 120 copies of your prize-winning Worship as Pastoral Care, so make sure that they do that right. I was talking to one of our vicars in Michigan on Monday, who's giving his supervisory pastor a copy for Christmas, and we hope to see him back here next fall. Dr. Willimon received his MDiv from Yale in 1971, his Doctor of Sacred Theology from Emory and Atlanta in 1973. Prior to joining the faculty at Duke, Dr. Willimon was pastor of Northside United Methodist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. A singular recognition, I think, has to be, however, the fact that he shared the cover of Newsweek magazine last November with the Ayatollah Khomeini. Now, that is... This is not Dr. Willimon's confirmation picture, but inside the cover, on the on-campus cover of the issue, some of you, in fact, I got this from one of you, his picture appeared on the cover. Very interesting. It's a far better picture than the one on the page alongside, which you can hardly recognize, a gentleman by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, who likes to move around a lot when he has his picture taken. It's very blurred. As our guest for the Winchell Lecture on Effective Preaching, Dr. Willimon this morning will address the subject Preaching as Community Creation. And I'd like you to help me welcome to our community Dr. William Willimon. The podium is yours, sir. The pleasure is ours.
Thank you. Last evening, someone came up with a copy of the book and asked me if I would sign it. And I said, I'm delighted to. If you buy the book, you certainly deserve an autograph. He said, well, I didn't buy it. It was the dean gave it to us. I hope, though, that won't keep you from reading it later. But I enjoyed it. I've been looking forward to this visit and enjoyed my time among some of you last night. Want to talk about pastoral care and the difference for me it makes that the one who proclaims the gospel is also the one who cares for this family that the gospel creates called church. Began with an encounter overheard of two people talking on the occasion of the departure of their pastor moving to another parish. One person said, I just hate to see, hate to think of Joe leaving us. He's been such a wonderful pastor. He's been so helpful to me and my family during the terrible crisis that we went through while he was here. The other person responded, I couldn't disagree with you more. I don't think Joe was a good pastor. And she said, what do you mean? And she said, well, fortunately, my family had no great crisis during the 5 years he was here. We didn't have any great tragedy to deal with. We just came to church on Sunday morning. And I can honestly say, in 5 years of Sundays, Joe was rarely a pastor to us. What we witnessed was haphazardly prepared worship and poorly prepared, poorly thought-out sermons. Gunswitch which assumed that his schedule was more important than our needs on Sunday morning, Joe was not a good pastor. I tell that story not only to remind you how difficult lay people can be, but also to remind us of a truism, and that is that the majority of our people experience us as pastors in the leadership of worship and preaching the word and leading the liturgy. A pastor, of course, could set out on a Monday morning, spend 10 hours a day visiting families in your congregation, counseling. You would not be with as many people in as intentional and focused a way as you are on Sunday morning. And so the person who stands up to preach, by the very nature of that office and what that means, who that person is, it makes a difference in the sort of care that we offer. Well, as some of you spoke about this last night and would like to expand those thoughts, Jesus looked upon the world and said that he saw that they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. From time to time, this image of the shepherd appears in the Gospels. Last night, I looked at the Sermon on the Mount and saw the shepherd Jesus minister to his sheep. Yet I know that when I was in seminary, I heard a good deal of criticism of this image of the pastor as shepherd. It was criticized because it was said that the sheep shepherd image promoted a kind of authoritarian pastoral style. It promoted a passivity on the part of congregations, dominant pastors, submissive laity. Instead, we were urged to be encouragers, enablers as pastors, quietly standing in the wings, urging the laity to assume their God-given freedom and autonomy. Under this new image, if some of these laity fell by the wayside, as many of them did in mainline Protestantism, we attributed their falling away to their inability to accept the freedom which we gave them. We couldn't, of course, help them unless they really wanted to be helped. They knew when we had office hours. We left them to fend for themselves so far as their spiritual needs were concerned, helping themselves to the smorgasbord of pastoral acts which we offered them, or else many of them found their way into more authoritarian churches which gladly offered to tell them what to do and be as a Christian. I now agree with Alfred Krauss, who charges that this, quote, laid-back, take-us-or-leave-us style of pastoral care owed a great deal more to the liberal worldview with its notion of the private, autonomous individual than it did to a specifically Christian theological perspective. In an article called Growing Together in Spirituality, Pastor and Parish Have a Checkup, Krauss tells how he led his parish through what he calls a spiritual checkup, utilizing a questionnaire which he constructed on the basis of Colossians 1, 9 through 14. As Krauss notes, too many of us mainline liberal pastors uncritically accepted the modern era's relegation of religion to the sphere of the purely personal and the utterly private, thus capitulating to the radical individualism of the modern worldview. Religion is a private affair. My spiritual vitality is my own business. It therefore goes against our liberal bias to have firm expectations of what people will do with their religious commitments. That's their private business, we say. The preacher is here as a kind of enabler to offer inductive suggestions, images, his or her own purely personal insights, rather than firm, specific spiritual direction. Now, that's rather odd when one compares how many of us mainline liberal preachers feel absolutely no such reservations about telling people exactly how they ought to respond to certain selected social and political issues. We quite readily tell them how to vote, what position to hold on Central America, nuclear disarmament. But when it comes to prayer, Bible study, scripture, service to others, examination of personal habits, we say, well, that's a personal, individual matter between them and God. Ally Cross have come to see this as a capitulation to the spirit of the age. We expect, for instance, our physician to take authority, to ask questions, to make prescriptions of diet or exercise, medication, when we have a spiritual checkup. Should we not expect the same direction from our pastors? I think one of the appeals of the more conservative churches is that many of them offer people a structure, a pattern, a direction to the spiritual life. And of course, as a United Methodist, I'm heir to John Wesley, who had a keen sense that there are some things in this life, indeed the most important things, that are just too important to be left up to chance, or feelings, or urges, or spontaneity of emotions. Hence the way we got our name, Methodist, because Wesley believed there could be a method to the spiritual life. Well, anyway, Pastor Cross devised a questionnaire which asked people such things as, once again based on the Colossians passage, do you believe that you bear fruit for the Lord? That you live a life worthy of Christ? Etc. He made appointments with his parishioners, gave them the questionnaire, and told them that the responses were only for them to see. He asked them then to take a moment and complete the questionnaire. And then he led them in a directed pastoral conversation about their assessment of their spiritual well-being, including ways to improve it. Of course, some of his parishioners either refused to make an appointment or repeatedly failed to keep their appointment. But overall, he said it was a positive experience for congregation and a signal that the pastor took active responsibility for helping them to grow spiritually. Krauss found that, quote, some people blame their lack of spiritual growth on their relationship to the church. Either they had changed or the church had, and they no longer found it to be meeting their needs. We explored the question of whether that feeling was likely to change and whether, in order to regain their devotion, they ought to look for another church. To some, he suggested journal keeping. To others, he recommended a special counselor. One parishioner confessed that she was alienated from another member of the parish and had been so for some time. Pastor Cross said, can you think of two or three things you could do to take initiative in this situation that might restore your relationship? They decided she should sit down and write a letter to the other person. Eventually, reconciliation was effected. Now, what appeals to me in Pastor Krauss's experiment with a spiritual checkup is the initiative he took in this matter. I visit lots of churches, and many of them, I mean, when you walk in the door, you can tell things are going downhill. And the image I always get is of the pastor sort of standing there wringing his hands as things crumble around him. And one wonders, why not initiative in this matter? It's the initiative that interests me here. Too many pastors act like secular mental health counselors, setting up office hours, sitting back, waiting for people to knock on their door for help. Of course, few knock on their door, except those with the most severe personal crises or the greatest need to seek out secular-style therapy. But how do we care for people who go through the day-to-day faith crises of fatigue, disillusionment, frustration, anger, misunderstanding with the church? Krauss says the checkups help me realize how little I really knew about the interior lives of my parishioners. A pastor who does not take specific steps to listen systematically to his or her parishioners doesn't know them. The congregation ought to be a sign to all Christians that we do not have to bear our burdens in isolation. It also ought to be a reminder to the pastor that he doesn't have to bear the congregation's burdens in isolation. I think if we pastors would spend less time trying to offer people one-to-one care in the form of a pastor trying to support an individual parishioner, and spend more time developing ministry of the laity within the congregation to others, as well as forming groups of mutual concern and all, the level of care would be greatly increased in the average congregation. You notice how we're talking about pastoral care now. We're speaking of
the difficulty of pastoral care, not simply making individual people feel better in crises they're going through, but we're talking about a crisis of embodiment, a crisis of building a family, a community of Jesus Christ, creating a people who are worthy of listening to Scripture like Matthew 5, which we spoke about last night. Remembering the example of Christ's spiritual checkup questionnaire, we pastors need to let our people know that their spiritual well-being is part of our responsibility. In our preaching and pastoral care, teaching ministry, administration, we've got to find ways to hold people accountable to their vision of themselves as Christians. Usually, I think we cannot wait upon the laity to take initiative in these matters. They may feel a deep, but usually an articulate need for more support and guidance from their church, but they are not usually the ones to come up with the creative solutions and the initiative. And I think simply because it takes courage, we're talking about deep matters here. We're talking about unleashing the demons. We're talking about delving into things that modern life has so many structures to help us carefully avoid. It takes courage to knock on that door, honestly to assess our Christian commitment. Perhaps we have so many passive, disengaged pastors and so many trivialized, superficial congregations because it's painful to dive beneath the surface. Who knows what will be unleashed? What carefully hidden secrets we will discover about ourselves? But I think the pastor is the one who must assume that courageous task. I wonder if part of our problem is our pastoral devaluation of our distinctive role as upbuilders of the congregation. In our day, we have witnessed a blurring of the distinctive ministry of the laity with the ministry of the clergy. Maybe this is not a Lutheran problem. I suppose I would rather read Luther speaking about the nature of ministry than anybody else. But I think this blurring, nevertheless, has accelerated the problem of the dissipation of spirit from both groups. Let's get this straight. All Christians, by virtue of their baptism, are laity, laos, members of God's family, the people of God through baptism. At baptism, all of us are given all the gifts and graces we need for ministry in the name of Jesus Christ. Yet at an early date, the church found it necessary to set apart some of these ministers for the specific ministry of caring for the congregation, empowering and equipping the whole people of God for God's work in the world. These priests or pastors did what was necessary to equip the church, including preaching and teaching, guiding, sustaining, although it was never intended that even these internal congregational functions would be carried on in an exclusive manner by the clergy. The great harm has been done in our day by a blurring of roles of clergy and laity, so that we've got laity acting like clergy and clergy acting like laity. Christians who are selected by God and the church to be clergy have their primary ministry within the congregation. The primary ministry of the laity, the people of God, is outside the congregation. Priests and pastors function primarily within the church so that the laity may be about their ministry in the world. Whenever priests or pastors engage in some ministry outside of the congregation, they do so as laos, as laity. I agree with my colleague John Westerhoff when he says that when priests work, say, in a soup kitchen or a home for the homeless, they ought to take off their clerical collars in order to make clear that they're there as laity, as baptized Christians doing the ministry that is expected of every baptized Christian, rather they're in some specific way as ordained clergy. Anyone who engages in ministries outside the parish, in counseling, in politics, in community service, does so as a member of laos. Many of our clergy are spending too much time doing work the laity ought to be doing, work outside the concerns of upbuilding and equipping the congregation, work that the laity ought to be doing by virtue of their baptism. Many pastors do such work, like running for the school board or teaching a course at the local college or political agitation, because of the implicit assumption so prevalent among mainline liberal clergy that the American church really doesn't need careful, sustained, long-term nurture. Because after all, the American church is lucky enough to live in a relatively Christian environment anyway. I feel that's a dangerous assumption. Clergy ought not to succumb to the imperialistic assumption that somebody has ordained us to care for the whole town, as if the whole town were Christian. Forming a faithful congregation and sustaining faithful Christians within American culture is quite enough work for the pastor. Too often, quote, lay ministry means running errands for the pastor, hanging around at the church all hours of the night rather than being about ministry in the world. The pastor becomes the surrogate Christian representative in the community, exhausting himself trying to run here and there doing ministry laity ought to be doing. The laity becomes second-class citizens at church, amateurs, waiting for something useful to do at church. No wonder many denominations, we've got an overabundance of clergy in many churches, and a clericalism which manifests itself in two ways: depreciation of the laity and their call to minister, with appreciation of the clergy and the ridiculous expectation that they are to minister for everybody else. I wonder if this confusion is a theological source of much of the reported problem of clerical burnout. The clergy are exhausted by trying to do everybody else's ministry. The laity, on the other hand, are frustrated by the trivialities of confining their ministry to keeping house at church. I would think that if a pastor spending more than a day a week engaging in activities beyond the upbuilding of the parish and its people, he or she is neglecting pastoral responsibility. On the other hand, if a layperson is spending more than 10 or 15 hours a week at church, that person is probably confused about where real ministry is. These statements arise in part out of a theology of ministry and in part about a theology of about some assessment of what needs doing in our culture. Remember last year I was speaking down in Texas, and after my sermon we had a kind of talk back session, and the pastor began by saying that his model theologian was Paul Tillich. He said to me, you know, you have such a negative view of the world. You seem to be so pessimistic. Maybe it's because you're from North Carolina. I said, well, I noticed that, you know, you have an automated lock system on the door of your church, but go ahead. He said, I feel that the church needs to relate to the world. There are many positive things we can find out in the world. I think government is not nearly as negative as you portray it to be, and went on. So I said, okay, and that's, we have a difference of opinion there. Well, on my way after the discussion, I was somewhere out in the parking lot. There were a group of women congregated out on the sidewalk there, an animated discussion. As I was walking by, they said, one of them called me and said, we're talking about you. And said, really? What are you talking about? And I went up, walked up to them, and they said, we're all school teachers. We're all public school teachers. And we were just talking about the difficulty of going from here on Sunday night to there on Monday morning, and how really tough it is. One of them said, I will stand up in a fourth grade classroom where I have two students addicted to drugs and at least a dozen students who for all intents and purposes have been abandoned by their parents. And said, I said, an inner city, and she says, oh no, this is a suburban elementary school here in this small city in Texas. And I said to them, you know, I wish some of you people would go back and talk to your pastor. He thinks this is a great town. And darn it, you get in there and you demand enough stuff to help you go back and be a Christian in that classroom on Monday morning. That's what laity must demand of pastors, and we pastors ought to agonize with that. The primary reason for worship renewal, I think, is not because people are bored and want to do some new things, new language and all. For me, the primary reason is that many of us are waking up and feeling that Sunday morning just isn't theologically adequate. We're not giving them enough stuff to carry out of there on Sunday to live the gospel with the kind of challenges. And of course, you know, we didn't have to worry about that. Sometimes Methodist pastors say to me, we got along for years without worrying about changing the worship and doing that and all. And I think whether it's debatable whether we got along or not, but we got along, you see, because we assume that, look, the church doesn't have to work too hard at this because they'll go out of church and they'll walk back into a basically Christian culture that will support what they're doing as Christians, that will confirm basically Christian values. As I said last night, I don't meet anybody today, Catholic, Protestant, Pentecostal, anybody who believes that anymore. Are we giving them enough? And I think that's a full-time job for the pastor. If the clergy are to be effective in the church, if our preaching is to mean something, laity have got to be engaged in the world as Christians. Constantly bloating back in the church, their frustration, exhilaration, and the demands of worldly ministry. So the pastor might minister to them. If the laity are to be effective in the world, their pastors have got to be effective sustainers, equippers for them in the church. The focus of the laity is on sharing Christ's ministry to the world rather than being too preoccupied with the church. The focus of the clergy is to be concerned with the upbuilding of the church rather than too distracted by the world. Perhaps our theological confusion about ministry is behind the frequently noted inability of pastors to say no. What I call promiscuous ministry. I'm not sure that pastoral work needs to be as diffuse and ill-defined as we sometimes make it appear. The inability to say no arises when we're unsure of who we are and what we're supposed to be doing. And so we say yes to everything out of a fear that we might slip up and say no to the thing we truly ought to be doing. The ability to say no begins with an inner certainty that our role as equippers and upbuilders of God's people is essential, important, and uniquely ours to fulfill. Of course, none of us are alone in our ministry to the congregation. Sometimes we may be coordinators of the upbuilding rather than the soul activators. Nor does this mean that we define the nature of pastoral ministry solely on the basis of our own opinions and commitments. Only through constant listening, negotiation, self-examination with the laity can a pastor really know what the job is within that specific congregation and that time and place. Because the needs of the world evoke the specific shape of ministry from the laity, and we cannot minister as pastors to their needs unless we're mutually clear about them. Because our pastoral roles are not clearly defined, though, pastors must be ever vigilant against the tendency of pastors to let important things crowd out time for the utterly essential things. I think the larger the parish, the less discretion a pastor has over his or her time, the greater the need for the pastor to set careful priorities in order to avoid being drowned in a sea of whatever happens to hit us first in the morning. At every turn in the road, we pastors have got to ask ourselves, is there anybody else in this congregation who can do this better than I? Every time pastors take over some area of ministry that someone else in the congregation ought to be doing, the pastor is robbing the laity of their rightful ministry. Ladies sometimes wonder, why is there so much poor preaching in the church? After all, they assume that they're giving the pastor plenty of time to prepare good sermons. But then we pastors reply, well, if I weren't looking after the gymnasium and administering the school and doing this and doing that, to which the laity ought to reply, well, that's the pastor's idea of ministry. The pastor never asked us what we needed doing here. When pastors are uncertain about the value and the intrinsic worth of their vocation as enablers in the congregation, they trivialize their time, wasting hours in unproductive meetings, letting conversations drag on, in general wasting time because they have no overriding understanding which helped them organize their time. A sort of Pharisaism of the calendar takes hold in which we say to ourselves, I must be doing something significant here. Why am I so exhausted at the end of the day? And, of course, what is said of pastors setting priorities can also be said of laity. Laity need to be given help in deciding what is important and worth doing out of my Christian commitment. We're talking, and I think, therefore, if I had to isolate the one factor that I observe in my fellow clergy that is a real problem, it would have to be pastoral passivity. Many of us go in the ministry because someone told us, you're a nice boy. You ought to be a pastor. And we believed them. And few of us go into the pastoral ministry out of a love of confrontation or aggressiveness or assertiveness. We're peacemakers. We're on the side of reconciliation and acceptance rather than confrontation and divisiveness. And generally those are positive qualities in a pastor. The trouble is the church also expects leadership of a pastor. Now, while Jesus was clear that our leadership in the church is to be different from that of the Gentiles, who lord over others with displays of power, there is no way to lead without the ability to take an active leadership role. The passive pastor sitting in the wings, waiting for the laity to take charge, to catch a vision, to move, waiting on the next opportunity to go to a really good church, is not the empathetic, servant-minded, non-authoritarian leader that he or she likes to think of himself as. More often, this pastor is someone who has rather arrogantly refused to assume the role of parish leader and serve the church by leading the church. After all, if the pastor never pushes any new ideas, never attempts to rally the parish behind some new cause or program, is never critical or impatient with present arrangements, the pastor will never be blamed when things don't work out. How to get pastors to take charge of ministry? To lay hold of the responsibilities which the parish lays upon them. Perhaps we should talk psychologically at this point. Perhaps we should talk about developing more assertive personalities. I'd rather talk theologically, because I've continue to have the suspicion that when we look at clergy, when we see a kind of crisis in leadership, we're looking at a crisis of faith rather than a crisis of psychological well-being. I disagree with Gary Harbaugh's claim in his recent book, The Pastor. I disagree with his claim that, quote, most of the problems pastors experience in the parish are not caused by the pastor forgetting that he or she is a pastor. Most difficulties pastors face in the parish arise when the pastor forgets that he or she is a person. Elsewhere, Harbaugh claims that studies of the transition from the seminary to the parish and other studies that have followed pastors through their careers suggest three major answers to the survival question. Self-care, two, a socio-economical support system, and three, self-awareness. The last of these is the most important. I think Harbaugh is overstating the psychological, personal component of clergy survival. Because for a pastor, than we say for any Christian. When you talk about my self-awareness, that involves the realization that I am baptized, that I am upheld and called and gifted and held accountable to Jesus Christ. I contend that this theological self-awareness is our most powerful resource for surviving and thriving in ministry. And by the way, Harbaugh does devote much attention in his book to spiritual development among pastors. The root issue may not be the psychological one of finding people to support us in our struggles or gaining enough ego strength to take care of number one and take a day off, but rather the theological problem of finding meaning in what we do in ministry. And when we raise the meaning issue, of course, we're talking theologically. Christians get their meaning and measure the significance of what we do from the church's book, the Bible. For here is the story that teaches us what to worry about in the first place and what to value. How is our service in ministry, later pastoral ministry, viewed from a biblical perspective? I think there's an illuminating episode in Luke's gospel. Surely one of the nastiest little stories Jesus ever told, as far as pastors are concerned. One day the disciples came to Jesus and said, increase our faith, is the first century equivalent of burnout. Jesus, you remember, tells them a little story in Luke 17. Will any of you, as a servant plowing or keeping sheep, say to him when he's come in from the field, come at once, sit down at the table? Will he not rather say to him, prepare supper for me and gird up yourself and serve me till eat and drink, afterwards you shall eat and drink? Does he thank the servant because he did what was commanded? So you also, when you've done all that is commanded, you say, we are unworthy servants who've only done what was our duty. This story of the faithful servants is preceded by Jesus' warning to beware of scandalon, beware of stumbling blocks to faith. And I would believe that a chief stumbling block is the expectation that somehow our ministry is going to be affirmed or confirmed by its recipients. Of course, affirmation is a basic human need, but it makes all the difference in the world where ministers expect to get their affirmation. I can tell you, affirmation is often in short supply in the average congregation. Because maybe they understand the nature of this parable better than we. The parable suggests that the source of renewal and rejuvenation for ministry, lay or pastoral ministry, that the restoration of faith finds itself in renewed attentiveness to the Master who calls each of us into service. The tough task of Christian ministry is the liturgical task. Namely, the tough task is the constant daily increasing challenge to take Jesus a little more seriously and ourselves a little less so. The significance of the servant is incomprehensible apart from the projects and desires of the master. The master defines the shape and validates the significance of faithful service. That is why diakonia is interrelated to liturgia. Times for prayer, meditation, study are linked to our ability to minister, not because such times of reflection offer us an opportunity to delve deeper into our egos, unworthy servants as we are, but because such times offer us an occasion to more clearly see the Master. As Augustine said, we tend to imitate whom we adore. And so one of the toughest tasks of the pastoral ministry is the job of making oneself more attentive, and I hope more adoring, of the one who modeled ministry with basin and towel, the one who came not to be served, but to serve. As he said, leadership shall not be so among you as it is among the Gentiles. A few years ago, Robert Wilson and I did a study of small churches in rural North Carolina, small United Methodist churches. And basically, we found something that I'm sure will not be news to a lot of you, and that is ministry in the small congregation is no picnic. We found a lot of pastors who were depressed, demoralized, cynical, and I suppose that's not news. But occasionally, in some little out-of-the-way crossroads, we stumbled across a pastor who, in all sincerity, could say that he or she just really loved being there in ministry. And we wondered why. And I know we asked, one particular pastor we were discussing with a church bureaucrat, church official, and we asked him, why do you think that pastor is so effective, so happy out there? And he said, well, he's got no ambition. And we looked for another explanation, and we decided that if you are someone who looks for validation of your ministry among your peers or within the system, within the institution, you're going to be miserable in a small membership church. You just can't deliver that. But if you're someone who finds validation within the intrinsic task of ministry, who has a confidence that those tasks are just intrinsically valuable, the small membership church often affords you much more satisfaction than a larger parish. Here was a man, for instance, who was just thoroughly enjoyed the intellectual task. He didn't think of himself as an intellectual, but he was. The intellectual task of taking a biblical text, mulling it over all week, thinking about it, looking into it, and then preaching it on Sunday morning. Just that activity invigorated him. And it made no difference whether you preached it to 10 or 100. It was that task which made a difference. Every minister, clerical or lay, is tempted to abandon the task of service to the master and make do with simply being popular or effective as the world judges such things. I've been working on a book on ministerial burnout. It was kind of an embarrassing book because halfway through it I decided I didn't believe in burnout. as everybody else described it. But I found myself in a kind of a trap. I was saying, you know, every minister ought to take a day, the same day off every week. I don't, but you should. And you ought to develop a support group of your peers. I've tried that, and sometimes it works, and many times it doesn't. But then I finally got down to it, and I said, look, you can't pay people to do what ministers do, to do what pastors do. And a day off a week isn't going to do you a bit of good if you're miserable out there in the ministry. I got down to the very old-fashioned claim that either you're called by God to do it, or there's just no point in doing it. Either you have a kind of confidence that God wants you to do this for reasons not only to God, and that God is working through this church to do it for reasons known only to God, or you're miserable. And I don't know of any kind of counseling or personal support that will pump that up. It becomes a kind of theological issue. I mean, many times at Northside Methodist Church, toward the end of the day, I would sit down 4:30, and I would pour a cup of coffee and pour a cup of coffee for God and say, now let's go over this again. what gave you the idea that it was good to have a Methodist church on Summit Drive in Greenville, South Carolina? I can't see it. And we go back over that again, and then I'd say, well, I know, but why these people? If I were building a church, I could have gotten together a better group than the ones that are here. Let's go over this again. Ministry is therefore either based upon our conviction that God really is present in the church, in word and sacrament, doing something that cannot be done in any other way for the world, or ministry is misery. In the end, our service is validated not by whether we find it particularly fulfilling, often we don't, or whether the world finds it useful, usually it doesn't. In fact, surely the great surge of interest among Protestant clergy in the last 30 years in pastoral counseling, surely part of that is that pastoral counseling is the last socially acceptable thing left for ministers to do. It's the last thing that the whole world approves of. I mean, try this. You're at a party sometime, and people ask you, what do you do for a living? And, tell them, I mean, lie one time. Say, I'm in counseling. And they light up, and they say, oh, I know that you must do a lot of good for people, in spite of the fact there's very little empirical evidence to suggest that counseling does. But I noticed in my last congregation, counseling has become, I mean, for everybody, for the person on the street, when a couple maybe was thinking about ending their marriage, having a divorce, people would always say, oh my, that's terrible. Have they been for counseling? And you say, yes, they have. And I said, oh, well, then maybe it's the right thing to do. And so I told people, I said, by the way, our church is divorce is a sin unless you've been for counseling. And then it's okay. Well, The only real validation is that what we do or say is in service to Jesus Christ. We pastors serve God by serving a people who need no other service than to have their lives, their attentions constantly directed toward the living God. Failing at that, temptation is to work for adjustment to the status quo or congregational conviviality where the minister becomes a kind of recreational director on the love boat. There's a kind of atheism, if this is too strong a word, a kind of atheism at the root of many ministerial models today. An implicit assumption that God really doesn't matter as we go about building bigger and more active churches, church administration, developing self-esteem in our congregations, worship, helping discontented individuals adjust to their circumstances, pastoral counseling, enabling troubled souls to justify their basic self-centeredness, ethics, and offering Jesus as a worthy subject of poetic reflection. Preaching. We go about assuming that it's up to us to make the kingdom of God happen. It's all on our shoulders. When we're faced with troubled people, we're told by someone like Henry Nouwen to share ourselves, to practice the ministry of presence. That's a dead-end street. Because you get out there, you find that human needs are just too terrible and great for you, even you, to minister to those needs alone. They will eat you alive if you try sharing your presence with them alone. Pastors without God have to work day and night, breathlessly trying this and that, urging the laity to do the same, convinced that all we need is a little better preaching, a little more dedication, deeper personal empathy to bring in the kingdom. No wonder many report that they're suffering. We are servants of the Messiah rather than Messiahs ourselves. And servants are only significant as instruments of what the Master is already doing. Oh, we preach justification by grace, but do we model it in our ministry? Sometimes we pastors act as if everybody in the church is justified by grace but us. We determine the boundaries, the goals, the mission of the church, and then when our expectations are not reached, who is there to blame? In substituting utilitarian, socially approved concepts of ministry for the scandalous gospel insistence that our ministry is but a reflection of God's activity in the world, we forfeit any means of dealing with the inevitable tragedy and failure which faithful ministry always entails. Can we trust the Master to use our unworthy efforts in service of what the Master wants? If we pastors want to go out and help people, people in seminary have always, as a class, I often start by having to go around the room and say, how did you get here? What led you into ministry? And there are always a number of people who say, well, I like working with people. And I say, well, have you ever actually met any of the people you'll be working with? I can show you people that you will not like working with, that well, if we pastors want to go out and help people, this parable suggests the most helpful thing we could do is to give them something worth doing for someone who is worthy to be caught up in that. I mean, the hardest working people I know and some of the most fulfilled are musicians, artists. I'm thinking like my organist who will drive me to distraction playing the same phrase of some fugue over 50 times on the organ outside my office. And when I go out and complain, she says to me, well, you, you know the music deserves it. You would understand that. And then I go back in my office, and I get back to work on the sermon, because the music deserves it. I remember when one of John Wesley's preachers came to him and complained that he was losing his faith. Wesley turned to him and said, "You go out and you preach faith till you have it." And it was a kind of no-nonsense reply that it's not by delving into ourselves, but it's delving into the mystery of God that faith arises. And so we come back. What does pastoral care have to do with preaching? All these comments are based upon the implicit, and I hope at times explicit, assumption that it is in the preaching task that sets the tone for all ministry. And one reason preaching is so frightening and also so exhilarating is that we have the good sense to know that somehow it all rises or falls when the word is opened up and we speak it within the family. And if it doesn't happen there, it's nothing is going to happen. And that's a frightening, wonderful moment, which is at the very source of our ministry. I'd love to be able to stand up and tell you that I always feel loving, invigorated by the task of ministry, challenged by my people, loved and affirmed by my board. Unworthy as I am, I'm not. And so I at least try to follow the advice of Luke 17 and be absorbed by something or someone greater than my feelings. I at least try to do my duty. And I'm proud to report that on most days, by the sheer grace of God, it's enough. Thank you.
I think that says something translated like, "Thank you very, very much." You know, Dr. Willimon, on a sunny, snow-laden day in St. Louis, it's very hard sometimes to remember that we do indeed live in a fallen world. And we thank you for reminding us that we do, but particularly the glories of the pastoral responsibility we have to God's people who live in that world. Now, I know some of you have commitments, and I know you have an airplane soon to depart, but I am certain that Dr. Rowan would be more than pleased to entertain questions that those of you who can remain for some time may wish to direct to him, and I'm going to ask you just to point your finger at those that do and respond, if you will. Thanks.
Can we do that here?
Okay.
Have you got any response? If you wish to stay? Oh, yes.
Never.
There are many United Methodists who would love for you to call me. They would be glad to I'm not that good a Christian. I wouldn't last very long in the bureaucracy. I just wouldn't. I guess some of it is related to my concern about, to use the word I didn't quite believe in, but burnout, sticking with ministry. So perhaps it'll appear there. Well, thank you. Yes. You mean a deeper look than the lecture? I've done some books on preaching. I don't know, books on preaching, and I've written a couple. They remind me of like books on sex. I think it's better to go ahead and do it and not. The books are never as interesting. I've got a little book called Integrative Preaching that tries to talk about the difference it makes that the preaching that's going on is done in a parish, that it's an interaction with the people. So I guess I look at it there a little bit. I don't. You people, though, traditionally, my impression, and as you can tell me this is wrong, but is that particularly in your denomination, there's been a continued, maybe to the point of distraction, emphasis on both preaching and on the primacy of doctrine in as the rudder for the church. I don't know how relatable my thoughts were. It seemed to be somewhat, but well, you had. Well, I don't have any great formula. There are others who know more about congregational dynamics than I, but I just, first of all, it is very important to listen to where they are. I mean, when you go to a new congregation, develop some systematic way of sitting down and asking people, what do you love about this congregation? What is the biggest problem in this congregation? If you could write out my job description for the next year that I need to work on, what would that be? You get some amazing things that way, which then you can go back. And then I think we underestimate how much people really value today teaching opportunities, I mean, for the pastor to teach, for the pastor to struggle with them over prayer and other issues. Once again, I believe we pastors have been slower than the laity to really realize that the church is a place where people are looking for equipment and they're looking for structure and help with their lives, and so I wanted to suggest take authority for that. I think it can take lots of different forms. I mentioned about the school teachers in Texas, and I was in a church where the pastor meets once a week with public school teachers for breakfast. and they have prayer, and they've tried case studies where teachers will bring in episodes from the classroom that are a challenge to their Christian faith. They do Bible study. And I thought that's an amazing idea. I did this with a group of businessmen in the morning, and I was afraid the traffic was moving the other way on the bridge, in the sense that I don't know how much I gave them, but time and again they jerked me up and reminded me of what a kind of sheltered existence I lived in. And there were more than one time when they'd talk about dilemmas they were facing in their business life, I would say, did any of you get anything out of my sermons on Sunday morning? I mean, here I am up there talking about the birds and the bees and everything, and you walk out and face life and death situations. And I said, thank you for rubbing my nose in that. And I'm going and rewriting next week's sermon right now. Good things happen, and lay people are flattered when we say to them, I really respect the ministry you're performing right now, where you are, and how can I help you perform that ministry better? Yes. I would say just worthy, namely, just by that I guess I meant we are made worthy, I think, by God's action in Christ, that one, these words are spoken to us, and we must take them seriously. And to be the congregation where I don't protect my people from the word, but rather I make them stand in the face of it. And not only that, but it's clear that I stand under the word too, with them. So many times it's me and Jesus up in the pulpit giving it to the rest of them. I need to see Jesus in the pulpit, and then I'm out on the third pew from the right reacting to it, saying, I can't do that, or that's too much, I can't. And that's worthy. By that, I guess I just added mine, a congregation that is truly struggling to embody that word in its life together. Yeah, struggle with the word. I remember many churches around our area have gotten into letting lay people lead prayers of intercession. And I remember I was in a little congregation where a student of mine preached, and it was a very tough, I guess, quote, prophetic sermon. And you could just feel it. The whole congregation was just kind of hit by it. And this older man got up to lead the prayer, and the beginning of the prayer was, O Lord, we have heard your word, and we don't like it. And there was kind of stunned silence, and he said, because you know how we are, Lord, but we're asking you for strength to be the kind of people you think we can be. And it was wonderful. And I thought, what a marvelous thing. And I like the fact that, well, you've always, I guess, had this, but in our liturgies now, the sermon is moved early in the service, and the prayers are moved later in the service, so that those prayers of intercession now start to really mean something, because many times these are people, we're people who have been devastated by the word, and now we come to God empty-handed and say, Lord, make us a kind of people who can hear this. So I think that's what I had in mind. Yes. Thank you. two emphases being, well, the accountability, I think, is that we, pastor and people, are engaged in a constant dialogue of holding ourselves up before the Word. That word, for instance, when I think of accountability, tells me that I am sinful. And that when I speak to anyone else, I speak as a sinful person who has been, who is being redeemed by the work of God in Christ. Let me get more specific. I'm thinking in the average congregation, we ought to encourage structures of accountability. I remember a group in my congregation reviewed this dramatization of nuclear war, the morning after, it was called, or the day after or something. And when we finished viewing it, our resident kind of radical activist, a young woman in the congregation, started talking, and she was telling me, she said, honestly, that, I think it was Henry Kissinger was one of the respondents, something, he made me so mad, I just said, just his attitude about peace and all, I could have just punched him in the nose when he said so-and-so. An older woman in the congregation looked at her and said, well, I gather you and Mr. Kissinger have a great deal in common then, in the way you respond to things. And that's just a little moment, but it was a moment in which this person in her righteousness saw, and she kind of smiled and she said, thank you, you're right. You know, she says, my problem is we're not dropping the bombs on the right people, as she said, but it's wrong. And that moment of realization, I don't know, I don't know how to make it happen, but I think we can encourage it, accountability. Now, the other aspect you lifted up was the proclamation of the justification. There's a sense in which all of it goes together, and I often experience my own justification most vividly in those moments when I realize I can really hear the Word and respond to it, even in my sinfulness and even in my self-deceit, which is massive. I can truly examine my life courageously. That must be a gift of God. Let's call it justification, that enables me to be more than I thought. And I think someone was noting last night that when pastoral care is offered, when I go to visit someone in the hospital, I go as preacher. And many times, you know, when someone is in the hospital with serious illness, you don't have to go through the great doctrines of the church. You can go and offer empathy. Because you've already been through the great doctrines of the church at another. This is a person who's listened to those sermons. And as one woman said to me, I've listened to 32 years of sermons for the possibility that I would know how to act in this moment. And so we sometimes underestimate the pastoral care stuff we do when we lead people in prayer, when we have a layperson read the gospel in the Sunday liturgy, when we baptize a baby. I was with a couple one time, they were talking about divorce, and they said, I said, why are you getting a divorce now? And they said, well, we've realized that we're only staying together really for the children. And I said, well, by the way, I think I can speak for the church. That's an excellent reason to stay married. There are a lot of people who are staying married for lousier reasons than that. But we're on the side of the children. We're not that concerned about your happiness. Remember when we married you, we never even promised you happiness, and we were upfront about that, but you produced a vulnerable, little, weak human being, and we're on the side of vulnerable, weak, dependent human beings. So we think that's a great reason to stay together. And then one might remind them, look, were not you the same people who brought this child for baptism, and did we not all make some promises there? I mean, I'm interested in our liturgy and our preaching setting the context for our care. And I had a young man in my office a month or two ago was suffering from depression, which is horrible. And I, of course, first asked him, have you been under the care of a physician, a psychiatrist? And he said, yes. I'm for people suffering from illnesses being under the care of a physician. And he said, well, my psychiatrist said I kept talking about religious stuff. He suggested I come see a preacher. And I said, well, great. Let's talk about some religious stuff. I said, tell me about your life at this point. And he said, well, I just feel so weak. I just feel so, and here was this strapping, good-looking young man, already graduated from college, but he had not been able to get up enough confidence to go out and look for a job, to said he hadn't been able to date. He said, you know, it's odd. When I was a senior in high school, I had more self-confidence and believed in myself more than I do now that I'm a college graduate. And I said, well, I explain that to you quick. You had more self-confidence because you were stupid. Everybody at 18 thinks that. I mean, you had a block letter sweater and all. But I said, the amazing thing to me is how wise you are now. I mean, you've told me, I feel weak, I feel dependent on others, I need other people to get by. I said, that's good. You've actually gotten an education here. I don't meet that many people who learn as much as you do this early. A lot of men don't learn what you do till they're 50 and after their first heart attack, but you're a fast learner. And you see, in our faith, you go forward by falling back, and you don't even get in unless you're a little child. And look at the progress you've made. You're little now. And he said, you know, well, the psychiatrist has not told me these things. And I said, I know. But I'm telling you these things because you've already told me I'm someone who is trying to live by Jesus Christ, and Jesus, I think, would say you're just very close to the kingdom right now. And so what the world is telling you is failure may be just incredible success. I said, you're ready now for life because you know things that you won't have to learn later. I'm just impressed by how the gospel is this peculiar worldview that calls into question assumptions that everybody has and urges us to attend to the world differently. And the preacher is engaged in laying on the story on that. We need to end her. Well, thank you. I sure enjoyed being with you.
Safe in assuming that we would be delighted to have you return at any time.
Thank you all.
Oh, any of you that have these slips of fourth year concluding colloquy, you just see Henry or Val up in the office, or Scott Rishi, Professor Professor Feuerhahn, if you want to turn him in and just pick up a book in the office.